I'm Justin Landon, and this is Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. I have with me tonight two of the most brilliant artists in the field, Victo Nye and Jeffrey Allen Love. Victo is a New York-based illustrator who's created art for a host of clients, including our very own Tor.com and Tor Books. Jeffrey Allen Love has a creative writing degree, but paints instead. He teaches at Virginia Commonwealth University. Also has a lot of clients, including Gallants and our very own Tor.com. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me. And us.
So Jeff is a degreed creative writer. Can you help me a little bit with what the appropriate verb to use before art is? You know, like you write books, you make music. What do you do art? How does that, do you make art?
Or bleed it, maybe. I don't know. I actually was a horrible English major. I don't know any of those things. I think that's maybe why I ended up an illustrator.
And do you teach art at VCU, or do you teach something else?
I do. I teach illustration, and it's they might not want me to say this, but I actually dropped out of VCU, and then they asked me to come back and teach. It's kind of like a dirty secret, but it gives me a lot of pleasure to be able to say that.
That's awesome. What about you, Victo? What do you think? Do you make art? Do you create art? Do you paint art? I mean, I'm very confused by this.
I think bleed is a good word, or live, because you can't really separate it. It's not like other job. You can't separate your professional and personal life at all. You're drowning it pretty much.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, that's an interesting way to describe it, when you drown in a piece of art. I mean, so when you're working on a piece, Jeff, do you completely dive into that one piece and work on it exclusively and just bleed it onto the page until it's done?
No, you can't. I guess you can't really work that way because, you know, you're working on a lot of things all the time, and illustration is a little different than fine art in that, you know, you're working with other people, you're working on deadlines, so you have to always be aware of kind of time issues. So sometimes you're just working on one thing, but often you're working on a lot, and you have to kind of be able to move back and forth. So it kind of varies. You have to kind of become really good at knowing how long you need for certain things, and some pieces go really quickly and some don't, and it's something that you stress out a lot about, at least I did early on, although I'm still very early in my career. But as I've grown in my career and become more confident with my personal voice and my art, I find that that I kind of have a better feel of how long I need for something, and I kind of front load, I guess, the emotion and the drowning in it. And that's all in kind of the idea and the how I make it personal for me and how I make it meaningful and something I want to work on. And then the execution can sometimes just turn into a race against time of if I actually am able to, you know, make the deadline. And I'm sure Victo is much busier than I am. And so I'd be interested to hear how she does it, because it's for me, I live in a city where I don't have, you know, like my rent's super cheap, and I can kind of be a little more leisurely about work, I think, whereas I imagine Victo, at least from seeing your output, you know, I can only imagine what how many late nights you put in.
Yeah. not a million, because I can't juggle that many.
We're getting a ton of reverb.
How about now? Better?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay. Yeah, it was horrible. I hate hearing my own voice.
It's the worst, right?
Yeah, I thought I sound deep like Scarlett Johansson, but then when I hear it, it's like a kid. So it makes me really sad.
It's true of all of us. It's been the worst part about podcasting is I have to listen to myself for hours afterward.
Yeah.
Because it's always my voice that needs way more work because of, like, I'm always correcting volume levels. And so I'm always having to edit my voice a lot to get my volume right. And so, yeah, it's been pretty obnoxious. So anyway, let's, where were we? We were, so Victo, do you find yourself working on 1,000 different things at once as well?
No, I don't, because I physically can't. I have friends who can finish a piece within like an hour and two, and that really make me want to kill myself, because for editorial jobs you get paid by page, so they pretty much can take on like 20 30 jobs a month, and for me I can at most like 8, and that's really stretching it. Like, if comfortably, I will do around like 5 or 6 jobs a month, and I still work a long time. Yeah.
Wow. And what about you, Jeff? How many are you doing in a month?
You know, it kind of depends on how many I get, I guess. But I would say about four to five. I'm doing a lot more book covers now, so that's it's interesting to me that you know, like, it's a lot more fun because I love it a lot more, and also the deadlines are longer, so my illustration life has kind of become more leisurely in a way. I do miss the heart attack of a New York Times op-ed of 4 hours or 5 hours of insanity. Right. So maybe give me a call, New York Times.
I guess we can jump off from there a little bit into, you mentioned something about cover work sort of being a first love or something that you've really been looking forward to doing in your career. Is that true of you as well, Victor? I mean, is cover work in publishing or in books, is that something that you always wanted to do or something that you've just sort of found your way into?
I think I always wanted to do, but for me, it's actually trickier. Like, I think Jeff's style landed really elegantly into book covers because my stuff is so detailed and many times very narrative. I sometimes think that my book cover kind of ruined the story. Like, it doesn't have the same kind of abstract, atmospheric, like, beauty that just allure you to the sensibility of the book. When I get hired to do a book, a lot of time I get hired to do a scene. So I think that's the difference between my stuff and Jeff's stuff. So I actually do more editorial work than book covers.
And, yeah, it's an interesting comparison. I was thinking and preparing for this interview, and I was looking through both of your galleries and your catalogs or whatever, you portfolios. There we go.
Yeah.
I'm an expert at this art business. Your portfolios. When you look at Jeff's work, like, I always feel like you get that very sort of, leaves you with a very particular emotion.
Yeah.
Which is probably 9 times out of 10, not the emotion that Jeff is going for, but it's the one that you get as the viewer.
That's very flattering to hear Victor say that. So thank you. And I guess so. I was a fan of Victo's before I started working. I've only been working for maybe 2.5 years now, and she was sort of an inspiration of someone who had a very clear voice. And I think that's probably why you've picked the two of us, maybe, and maybe why Irene has worked with us, is that we both have sort of this clear, distinctive voice that sort of separates us, and we're pursuing different things. And I think that you hit it pretty much on the head that for me, my work in the last year and a half or 2 years is all about emotion and trying to distill the story or my feelings about the story into an image. And you know, it's in any sort of art, like, once you've made it, it's in the hands of the viewer and whatever they bring to it. That's kind of fun to do, is that I'm asking kind of an open-ended question, and whatever personal experience or feeling they bring to it, that's great, as long as they have a feeling, at least, you know, feel something, you know, react to it, hate it or love it, you know, don't just have a, you know, it's just another book on the shelf. You know, I'd rather have people look at it and you know, have some sort of emotion to it.
Yeah, totally.
One of the reasons I chose the two of you tonight for this particular show is because I think both of you breaking into cover work, particularly science fiction and fantasy cover work, is interesting because science fiction and fantasy art has historically been incredibly literal.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of very clear illustration. There's not a lot of interpretation involved. I'm interested to hear you say, Victor, that you're often asked to do a particular scene because I don't see your art that way, or I certainly don't see it being as literal as a lot. I mean, it's certainly not like a Michael Whelan or even somebody like Carla Ortiz, who tends to go for sort of this very, it's not like a comic book. I mean, it's more realistic than that, but it's definitely right. Like they're trying to portray a very specific thing, where I feel like you're doing more than that. I mean, you're sort of maybe somewhere between what Jeff does and what they do.
Well, I try to, and if you look at my portfolio, most of the stuff is actually not for a book cover. So when I talk about more like a scene is for a book cover, because so far I've been mostly hired to do YA stuff, and I think that's a different demography. Is that the right word? Demography?
Demographic.
Yeah. Yeah. Then Jeff's stuff, and they usually want it to be quite clear. The buyers know what they're buying, so they want they're not pursuing as much of a mood, but more like the storytelling. But with my editorial work or like interior fiction piece for like New Yorker, then I would get to put in my own voice a little bit more. So I think it really depends on the project and the clients. But definitely, I think what Jeff's saying, evoking emotion, is like the ultimate goal of many illustrators, including myself. Yeah.
The one piece that I always look at of yours, Victor, that really does that the best for me that I've seen recently is the Jack and the Queen of the Green Mill.
Thank you.
That you did for Tor. It's I don't know if you've seen it, Jeff, but it's this really cool sort of a 1920s, I guess, sort of gangster image where the woman's dress is flowing down, and in the dress is this scene of, I don't know what city it is, but it sort of looks like Venice. It's got like these canals and these little boats on it, and it's burning.
Actually Chicago.
Oh, Chicago?
Yeah, it's about the Chicago Great Fire.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's awesome. It's a great piece.
It's beautiful. I love that one.
Thank you. I actually luck out, like, because my first book cover or the like story illustration I did were for Irene Gallo for Tor. And Irene is like really, really open-minded, and she really believes the best work is having just like let the artists do their own stuff, like hiring the right artist for the project and not to manage it too much and just kind of let them, you know, breathe into the piece. And that's why I get away with more of the kind of surreal image with Irene. Like, that scene is not even in the book. It's just a metaphor that I thought is appropriate for the story, because it talks about this creature called the Shades, which can take on any forms, and they were being killed off by the Chicago Fire. It was actually like a genocide conspiracy. And they didn't die off, so some of them come back and take on the form of like a 20s flapper and seek revenge on the people. So I thought, you know, having the fire and the dress symbolize her history and the reason why she was there, but also her rage of the burning fire. But like, this kind of concept doesn't always fly with every client. And I think I got really lucky working with Irene. It's always a pleasure.
What I've noticed, I mean, I've been getting in more and more into art the last year or so, really taking time to get to know a lot of the artists and their work. And Tor.com in particular has been an absolute, it seems to have been an absolute boon to the artist community, just because Irene's been able to take so many chances on the website.
Yeah.
Because they're giving it all away, right? So there's not that pressure of like, it has to look good. It has to meet expectations on the shelf.
Yeah. I think when it's actually printed, there's a lot more things other than the art. There's like the marketing team, there's the editors, there's like Barnes & Noble telling you what sells and what doesn't sell and what kind of image it should look if it's a certain kind of category. So like, it becomes a little harder because you have all these rules before you even started. So yeah, I think that's the difference.
Jeff, yeah. Do you think that's a big reason why we see, and I don't want to put you guys in a weird position of having to comment on other people's work, but it's why we see people like Chris McGrath and people who have these very distinct styles that look really similar across book just continue to find. I mean, he does so many covers every year within science fiction and fantasy. He's not alone. I mean, obviously Michael Whelan does a ton and Larry Rostand does a ton and Michael Cormark. And they just do so much work. Is that because art directors and Barnes & Noble and sales and marketing people are just looking for, well, it worked before?
Yeah, I think so. And part of me, and it's like the little kid still loves that stuff. I have a deep affection. I love this. I'm a reader. And so I have a nostalgia, I guess, for that stuff. And I guess I look at it as it's a business, and like those guys are probably, you know, they need to make money. They need to make a living. Yeah. And if that's what they're being hired for, and if that's what a lot of people are being hired for, then it totally makes sense to me that there's going to be people that, you know, that's their business. They make art in a certain style and manner because that's what the business is hiring. Totally. And yeah. And I, and so for me, it was a conscious decision, to not be one of those people and to be okay with that. And the reason was, is that, about like last January, I kind of had a false, a health scare where I thought I had cancer for about a month. And I decided that I was not going to make art, that looked like what other people wanted anymore. And I was going to do stuff that was important to me. And, luckily at the end of the month, it was, you know, a false positive, and I got to go on with my life and, kind of have this whole new life open up before me. But, for that month, I was just making fantasy art nonstop and realized that that was what I really wanted to do with my art and my career. And, so I've, there's definitely times where I wish I was busier and I wish I had more work, but I wouldn't enjoy making that work. It just would become a job. And right now it's not a job. This is like, it makes me happy to be alive, to be able to do this sort of stuff. So, but you know, some of the best, so I talk again, I guess, cause this is a tour.com thing. I was talking to Irene, in New York recently and was asking her about, you know, my style, I guess, for lack of a better word. And she said, you know, you're perfect for one job out of 100.
Yeah.
And I think I'm okay with that. Like, they're the guys who you see all over the covers, they're getting the 99 jobs maybe, or maybe they're getting 60 of the jobs, and then 30 of those jobs go to people who are good for just one of those jobs.
Yeah.
But I'd rather be the person that's, you know, perfect for one than, you know, okay for 99. And, you know, I guess I'm okay with that.
You feel the same way, Victor?
Yeah, I think Irene said similar things to me too, because I like I mentioned, my first book cover was with her, so I thank her, and she was like, yeah, it's really hard to get a book cover job for you, but when I find the right one, it will be perfect. So
yeah, it's so interesting. I was talking to Irene the other day, and I was like, we've got to find a cover for Theo Prinz. I was like, let's get on this, Irene. I was like, I'm pressuring her to find a book she can use Theo Prinz on. Who's another one that I've been paying a lot of attention to, but it's so true. And it's nice to know that Irene Gallo, for those who don't know, is the art director at Tor Books. And it's nice to know that she's there and willing to push those envelopes.
Yeah.
You've worked with Gallants in the UK, Jeff. Are you guys experiencing other art directors willing to push the envelope, or is it not as many as you might hope?
There are definitely a few. Like for me, Sujin Buzelli. She's a creative director of Plan Sponsor, SS International. Also, the art directors in New York Times generally are pretty adventurous. I talked to Aviva about it, and she said, because we're a newspaper, they go so fast every day, so they have a very high demand for fresh voices. And I asked her, like, what happened when they flop it? Because you sometimes just get like a few hours deadline, and she said, well, then we move on. There's always tomorrow. Mm. I think because of that mentality, New York Times has always been, you know, very adventurous and very open with new illustrators.
Well, I guess a big part of that's got to just be that in publishing, the timelines are just so long. As you talked about it, Jeff, you almost feel like you're at a leisurely pace, but that pace and the plotting nature of publishing actually probably makes correcting mistakes really hard, because it takes so long. I mean, if you get a cover that isn't what you had hoped, you almost have to go with it because you don't have time to do another one.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm pretty recent in this, and so far all my experiences have been pretty great. Like you mentioned, Gallants was like a pretty ridiculous project for me to get, where they gave me 6 books, you know, just right off the bat. And they just told me to do whatever whatever I wanted. and it's like, you can't believe it when you get jobs like that. And
it's so awesome.
Yeah. And you know, like that amount of faith, you know, like, wow, like confidence is so important as an artist. Like when someone really, you know, buys into what you're doing and just says they want you to, you know, kind of be at the, you know, be the driver of the project in a way. And so that was that project really has opened up a lot of doors for me now, to where now, like most of the book covers I'm doing are for UK clients, because those are the people that go into the bookstore and have seen those covers in the store. And there's lots of people in the U.S. who have told me that they want to work with me. But again, it's that sort of we're waiting for the right job. And, you know, it may be that one out of 100. I don't know. I'm really enjoying it. I'm getting paid to read books, and I was reading them for free for a long time. So it's kind of a dream come true in many ways. And it's fun to be part of the industry and I don't know. It's exciting to me. I like it a lot.
Well, so Jeff, you've made it pretty clear during this chat that you've been a reader of genre for a while, going back. I mean, you've had a passion for it for a while and kind of wanted to get here. Victor, have you been a science fiction fantasy reader in your past, or is this something more recent that's kind of been the work has driven your interest in the area?
I would say it's more recent, but it's not because of work, but more like being exposed to the Western culture. I think for sci-fi, it wasn't as big, like where I was growing up from. And I think for most people here, they get into it during, like, you know, teenage time. So I kind of had like a late start on it. But yeah, I've been listening to a lot of audiobooks, and most of them are like sci-fi fantasy genre when I work.
You actually listen while you work?
Yeah, I do.
That's amazing.
Why?
I always hear these stories about people that like listen to books while they're at the office, or they listen to like podcasts while they're at the office, and I'm like, I would get nothing done. I would just like sit there and listen.
It helps me because I can't drink coffee. So if I have to pull a late night, like a really exciting story will actually get me going. And I tend to listen to story of people suffering, so I feel like when I'm like suffering is nothing compared. Like right now, I'm listening to The Count of Monte Cristo. I mean, it's not a sci-fi, but it's kind of a classic. So I was working really late night, and I was listening to the part when he was in the prison. So I thought, okay, my life is not that bad. It's actually pretty good.
Edmond Dantès has it way worse than I do.
Right, exactly.
He has to talk to Napoleon. That's actually a great book. I love that book. It's one of the formative pieces of literature. I read it when I was probably 17, and it was one of the books that I felt... It was one of the first non-fantasy books that I read, so it was like my first sort of foray into what you might call like serious books.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's still pretty fun, so...
I still have a very magical sense in a lot of the fantasy, like pirates and smuggler, all the Eastern. I think it could be a fantasy book. It just doesn't have dragon.
Yeah, easily. In fact, I think if you're familiar with Naomi Novik, her sort of Temeraire series is sort of set in a similar era. And it's basically the same setting with dragons. I mean, that's basically the difference. Jeff, are you getting any work outside of science fiction and fantasy at this point in publishing, or is it strictly in the genres?
Yeah, I am. I still do magazine stuff, and I would love to work with more magazine and places. And again, I think I'm getting the same thing where with covers, where my work is sort of taken on a very particular. I don't want to say style, because I feel like my style is the way I think and the way I design and the way I actually the technique I use to make the art changes depending on how I feel or where I am that day. But it seems like again, people are holding out for certain jobs for me. And so
typecasting.
Yeah, I've been typecast maybe, but that's okay. Cause I get, you know, like I want to be, I would rather paint swords and arrows, and, you know, that stuff. So, yeah. I would say that I could be busier, but I'm at a very happy medium right now of getting to, have a very nice life of, I get to be a full-time illustrator and read a lot and go on walks, and I don't have too many all-nighters, and it kind of gives me cold sweats when I hear my friends talk about all-nighters. So I hope they stay away for many years.
All right, so you brought up technique. Let's talk technique a little bit. Victor, how do you compose? Whatever the right term is.
How do I bleed?
Yes, how do you bleed? How do you bleed? How do you bleed art?
I cut open myself and then pull my heart out and bleed it on the paper until it looks right.
So do you paint, or do you
no.
do digital?
I use pen and ink for the lines. and then I scan them and color it in Photoshop.
Okay. What about you, Jeff?
I do most of my sketches in Photoshop, and then it depends on if I have a long deadline or if I don't. And also, I've been doing a lot of traveling, so if I travel, I just do it in Photoshop. But if I'm in my studio, I like to use a lot of different things, and I get bored pretty easily. So I'll use I'll do monotypes or etching ink, weird stuff. I don't have a press, so I have to figure out weird things of like running over plates with my car or rolling around on it or whatever. I use house paint because you can buy it, like if you go to the like Lowe's or Home Depot, people will return gallons of paint that they don't like, but they're often like really beautiful desaturated colors. Oh. That are horrible for walls, but they're great for an artist. So I've got like, you know, a bunch of those that cost like $4 a gallon. And so I'll, you know, use those. I like, if I have like 2 months, I'll do an oil painting, but it's pretty rare to get 2 months on a piece. So it varies depending on how I feel and also kind of what the project demands. You know, if it's a very graphic thing, you know, I can do that in a day. If I do a much more atmospheric oil painting, it could be eight weeks of waiting for layers to dry every day.
Wow.
So you go from oil on canvas to doing a complete project in Photoshop or just on the computer?
Yeah. Like some of the sort of flat graphic things I can do in a day, I think. I usually don't paint on canvas because, again, that's expensive. So I just go to the hardware store and buy whatever is cheap, like Masonite or plywood or something, and paint on that. I learned that from Mark English, who's a golden age, or I don't know if he's considered golden age, but one of the last great illustrators back when illustrators lived in mansions and drove fancy cars. I studied with him, and he, you know, actually, maybe I shouldn't say this in case any of his collectors ever hear this, but he's not really worried about archival art materials, let's say.
Got to keep those margins tight.
Yeah. The powerboat doesn't fuel itself, if you know what I mean.
That's interesting. That's pretty incredible. You have, I mean, that you do so many different things. I mean, when I've looked at all of your art, I mean, it seems like all of your art looks like it's been done with brush strokes and things like that. I mean, you can really tend to see them. I mean, will you create like brush strokes in Photoshop?
Yeah. Some of the ones, you know, like you learn kind of how to cheat it. I don't really use that many brushes. There's like this obsession with digital artists with like other people's brushes. And usually what I'll do is I'll take an oil painting I've done or a print that I've made, and I'll make my own brushes from that. So that it'll have like this sort of cohesive mark making language across my pieces. But I used to worry that my work wasn't cohesive and that people would, you know, like expect you to have a certain style of working. But it started to seem like that was like you get an entry level job in an industry and then you stay in that job for the rest of your life and you're supposed to be happy with it. And so I just started turning in work that didn't look like anything before, nobody ever called me on it. So now I feel like a little more comfortable of kind of jumping around with technique and media and hoping that there's enough of my fingerprint on it for people to go, oh yeah, that's a Jeff Love piece.
Well, one of the things I've always heard from art directors that I've talked to over the years is that the thing that they sort of prize above all else is consistency. That when they call up an illustrator, that they know they're going to get the same type of work or the same quality of work every time, and that ability to reproduce sort of really similar work. Is that something that you struggled with at first? I mean, Victo, do you sometimes have like lots of false starts before you get the right thing, or is that something you've just gotten a lot better at over the years?
I think I definitely get better, but I still struggle. And usually the better piece comes from struggling because it means I'm getting out of my comfort zone and I'm trying on new things. And I would agree with Jeff that I get bored really easily. So I kind of hate it if I have to do the same thing over and over again. And I think that's just not healthy in the long term for my creativity. So I try to change things up a little bit and try new things, but because of that, like, I have to struggle, but it's fine, which makes it fun.
You guys are just as tortured as authors.
Yeah, I mean,
we're more tortured, Victor, right?
I don't know, because I'm not an author, so I can't really say. It will be unfair, but sure.
Create a rivalry.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, I feel like there's actually a lot of similarities, I think, between the two communities of, like, artists and authors, and I don't know that they interact as often, perhaps, as they could or should. I mean, there's, like, a lot of sort of art-specific conventions, you know, like the Spectrum event in Kansas City, and I don't know, Illustra X, I'm not sure what that one is, but I always hear people talking about it. But then we have, like, our other, you know, sort of literary cons, where you'll get some, you might have, like, an art guest of honor, but they might be the only artist there, which is interesting. I just, they don't seem to overlap as much as perhaps you would think they would.
Well, I mean, even illustrator and graphic designer, you think we'll have a very close relationship, but we don't really. We hang out at different venues and we don't really cross over that much. So I think it's just most industries like that.
Everybody's got their own little niche.
Yeah.
Okay. So from the illustrator perspective, does it make you a little nervous, let's say, that with sort of we hear talk all the time of, like, the death of publishing, that publishing is having these financial struggles as a result of, you know, 100 different reasons why, self-publishing, but also, you know, everybody's spending their media dollars in all kinds of different places. And so we're seeing, it seems to me, and it again, it's just my own anecdotal experience, that we're seeing more and more cover work being done with photography, in some cases even stock photography. And I don't know if that's I'm sure it's both a cost function and a time function, perhaps.
Also a trend.
Or just a trend. I mean, I guess that's what I'm asking. Are you guys worried that this is not just a trend, but something driven by finances, or do you really think it's just a trend?
I don't really worry about it. I think, like, trend comes and goes if it's a trend. And like you say, if paper's dying off, there's always new medium. Like, there has been illustration for a long, long time. If you think of it, the Sistine Chapel is illustration. And it was done on the wall. And for a while, it was on tapestry. And it was on paper. And now it's on digital. And I've been working with a lot of online magazines. And they're great clients. And they're realizing now online's becoming a major platform that they're willing to pay the same as what print would be. So I think it's just like a change of media, but I don't think it will affect the existence of illustration that way. I think it will always be needed.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that the only reason you would have to worry about something like that is that if, as an illustrator, you're someone who is following a fad or a trend yourself. So you're kind of, there's plenty of people out there that you can tell that kind of become a copy of a copy of a copy. And there's this kind of group of people that sort of all look like someone. And, you know, someone blazed the way for that. And then all these people, you know, come in behind that and take the jobs because that's what people want to see. And so if that changes, then you're kind of out of work and you have to reinvent yourself again or find someone new to model yourself on. And I think that, again, kind of talking about maybe why you've brought Victor and I here and again, why I think Irene, the people that she hires for tour.com, they all have very strong personal voices and they have a very unique way of solving problems and composing pictures and making pictures. And so I think the best defense against the sort of changing, you know, the variance of the industry and, you know, the shifting winds and all that stuff is just to have as strong a voice as you can of your own art and to believe in it, because that people latch onto that and they respond to it. And I think that that's the best kind of like job security as an illustrator that you can have, is to really, you know, you owe it to yourself to really, you know, speak with your own voice, because people are going to hire you for that, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to kind of drop a little bit of a bomb in the middle of this. And last year, last December, I wrote a piece about gender parody and cover art in science fiction and fantasy. Mm. And I did a little bit of polling. I talked to a lot of art directors, and I pulled up the last couple of years of Spectrum, and I pulled, you know, obviously a lot of the award nominations, the Hugo Award and the Chelsea Award and a few others. And it seemed to be fairly convincing that the ratios were something like 70-30 on a good day and like 90-10 on a bad day.
Oh my God.
In terms of it favoring male artists.
Yeah.
And I had heard a few theories about why that might be.
Why? I'm interested.
Well, you know, one of the ones that I heard was that there are a lot of female artists working, but they're not working in science fiction and fantasy. They're working mm-hmm. somewhere else.
Right.
And so I guess I'll start off by asking you, Victo, do you mm-hmm. find that women are working in higher percentage than men in other fields within the artist community, do you think?
Not really. I mean, last year, American Illustration did a infograph listing all the, like, all the genders and nationality, and the female who enters is significantly lower than the males, and the one who got chosen is even lower. So I think it's all across the board that it's just less female illustrators.
But when I talk to somebody who's involved in some of the master classes and you know, some of the various other workshops that go around the country, you hear that the gender ratios are pretty even in those classes. So at the student level, perhaps it's...
Actually, at student level, it's 70% female in RISD and 30% male.
Yeah, in my classes, it may even be up to like 90% female and 10% male.
At, yeah,
some of them, it's a huge disparity.
Yeah,
and then we're seeing that paradigm flipped when it comes to finding work.
I don't know if it's finding work. Maybe it's just illustration or freelancing. Because I know a lot of like female classmates go into graphic design and art direction.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and there are, you know, I think that's even in the science fiction and fantasy community, a lot of the art directors are women, which is perhaps part of that. But it's interesting that, you know, certainly Irene at Tor.com has started hiring a lot of new female voices, people like Wesley Albrook and Carla Ortiz and mm-hmm. Lily Ibrahim and a host of others. And I think that's a really good sign, but it concerns me that we don't seem to talk. I mean, God, we're having endless conversations about it, and I don't mean that in a negative sense. We're having endless conversations about it on the publishing side, on the writing side,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't seem like there's quite the same uproar in the artist community. Or maybe I'm just not in the community, so I'm not hearing it.
No, there's definitely that conversation. I've partaken in that conversation a few times, and there's always speculation, but we never really know why. I mean, it's possible because just how, I mean, the freelancing lifestyle is pretty straining, and I don't know, it might not be a desirable choice of lifestyle, or...
I kind of agree with that, Victor. I think that the freelance lifestyle is, like, a lot of people want to be illustrators, but when they actually start doing the freelance lifestyle, they can't handle it. And, you know, like as a teacher, I'm concerned about that too, because I see my students and there are some really good ones. And I just hope they find traction. But I think that the hardest part is actually, you know, like the time it takes to really get going and to, you know, like not, you know, I say it's giving in, but it may not be to them. It may be that that for their life, it makes sense to have the security of health insurance, which it surely does. And, you know, like a paycheck and, you know, things like that. Whereas I was perfectly fine to be, you know, like a hermit for a couple of years and, you know, just kind of, you know, wait out illness for months. But I think in terms of actually the like illustration community as a like illustration field as a whole, I think the science fiction fantasy industry kind of has its own thing, where there's a much greater, this gigantic beast of fan art of like these internet things of people doing fantasy and sci-fi art, and they undervalue themselves, and they do it either for free, or they do commissions or whatever they're called for like $20, you know, and they've just completely devalued their work, and they stay in this very safe like fan community, and they don't branch out of it. And so I wonder if that keeps some people from actually trying to go after the publishing clients, you know, of trying to break into we'd call it the big leagues or like, you know, whatever, but places where you actually get paid what you're worth, you know, where you're as artists, we're valuable. We offer something that no one else can. We're hired for who we are and what we make. And, I think that fan art and, this sort of weird DeviantArt, sorry if DeviantArt is a sponsor of this or anything like that, but I think that they screw up a lot of artists with this sort of commission and like fan art stuff, and it keeps people from developing a personal voice. It keeps people from making a living from their art. It just kind of creates this sort of it makes me sad when I see people with so much talent not doing very much with it.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting though, because I actually have a good friend, and she's doing really, really well with fan art.
Yeah, yeah, no, I know people who like that's what they do, and they make lots of money from it.
Yeah, a lot.
Yeah, I don't know. It makes me sad when I see people who have so much talent that are making things for other people. Like, they could do so. I feel like they could do so much more with themselves, I guess.
Can I go back a little bit about the gender thing?
Absolutely. Please, just go.
Yeah, I just thought of it because I think I'm lucky to have more or less a, like, getting a living almost right away. So honestly, I wouldn't know what would it be like if I had to try for many years, because I think another thing for women is that you have the maternal clock. No, I'm not joking, because I'm serious about, you know, having a child, and you need a stable income to have a child. So I think that might present to be an obstacle for many. I'm just guessing that could be one of the reasons.
Well, particularly when you guys talk about things like all-nighters and, you know, having to crash on 8 projects a month. And as we've talked about, consistency is key. And being able to produce on time is key, and having a portfolio and a production schedule. And, you know, I don't know if somebody's only producing, you know, a couple a month, if they're ever going to get to the point where they can have a production schedule or a consistent schedule where someone's going to hire them, I guess, which is that same question of why we continue to see a lot of the same names get jobs. It's because, and maybe over time what we'll see, I mean, hopefully over time what we'll see is a lot of the work that Irene's doing at Tor.com and what, you know, what Glance is doing with you know, people like Jeff, that we'll start to see over time that those artists will start to get the jobs today, that today are going to the ones who've been working for 10 or 15 years today that are getting those 50% of the jobs that perhaps... It just takes time to bring in that new blood and to have them come underneath, because I know 20 years ago or 15 years ago when John Picaccio was breaking in, I'm sure he was frustrated that Michael Whelan and, you know, Daryl Sweet were getting all the jobs.
So maybe, cycle of life.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's just part of it. I mean, it seems that, you know, artists, they have a long shelf life. I mean, they can work for a really, really long time. It's not like some careers where you're good for 5 years and then it just all falls apart on you.
I think that's the beauty of sci-fi. It's not like that with editorial. It's very, very trendy.
Mm.
So if you look through like the annuals, like American Illustration, if you just look past like 5 or 6 years ago, you can tell like there's trends going on and things that used to be like hip and a lot of people were trying to go for that look has totally changed.
Maybe sci-fi and fantasy is a great place to set up shop and make a career.
Yeah.
It's like freelancer's paradise if you can get into the group that's working a lot.
Yeah. I actually think that it's a great time for sci-fi and fantasy in editorial too. I was talking to Sam Weber at last year's Spectrum, and I was talking about, you know, trying to get editors or art directors and editorial to go for my weird, you know, like, sci-fi fantasy stuff. And he was, and, you know, and should I try to do that? And he said, you know, in this post Game of Thrones world, they all love that stuff, you know? And so it kind of gave me courage to, you know, really to, you know, kind of push that stuff, in the editorial the wider world of illustration and not just sci-fi fantasy.
I mean, honestly, I don't see you as a sci-fi illustrator for the reason that we talk about, like, you don't have the very kind of house style. So I don't think you should give yourself a label at all. You should just pursue whatever that you feel right and you're interested in.
Yeah, I don't want to just you know, do that. I'd love to do stuff with, you know, like Penguin Books or,
yeah,
you know, places like that, you know, anywhere. And I've, you know, it just so happens that my childhood obsessions was sci-fi and fantasy, and so that's going to leak in somewhere. And to go back to the maternal clock, I'm kind of having a paternal clock too. That's why I laugh. I'm starting to get the paternal clock.
Yeah.
So I'm beginning to, you know, want, like, you know, I'm 36 now, so I started my career pretty late.
Oh, it's a challenge. You know, I have two small kids myself, and I'll tell you, it gets really hard to get anything done when you have children. And I can't imagine being a freelancer with children in the house. I mean, you, like, the whole home office would have to go away. You know, I mean, you'd have to go rent a space, that you rent a studio away from the house where you could go and get work done. Do you both work at home, or do you guys have an outside studio?
I work from home.
Jeff,
I work from home. I've worked in studios mostly for the last four years, I guess.
And Jeff, you did formal apprenticeships, right?
Yeah, I did an apprenticeship with Sterling Hundley, who's a like amazing illustrator and artist. I did that for 2 years, I think. It's weird because it was kind of on the edge of the apprenticeship, where everything's kind of digital now. So, like, I don't think that an apprentice really, I couldn't use an apprentice. I don't know what I would have them do. Whereas for him, I was, you know, cutting boards and printing out reference photos and gessoing things and stretching canvas and cutting things and, you know, doing all this hands-on stuff. You know, now I would just be asking them to go get me coffee and, you know, that's it, maybe. So, but it was irreplaceable. It actually, that was my art education. And he's if you don't know his work, you should look it up. It's wonderful. He really pushed, your brain is, you know, your most potent tool. And so he really pushed me to, you know, use my brain and not rely on just some sort of secret trick or technique that I learned. That was great.
I looked up his work earlier today, because I'm a dedicated researching podcast host, and and I was looking at his work, and I was struck by a couple of things about it. And part of it was, I was sort of looking at your work and his work and kind of comparing the two. I guess there's some mild similarities, but he does, like, some really interesting geometric things in his work. And then I was, like, sort of looking at Victo's work and then at your work, and I was like, oh, that's kind of, he's got some interesting things going on in there that I could see in both of your work. Because he does that, I don't know what you call that. It was like cubism or something, or like that, those geometric shapes. I don't know. I'm not very smart.
That's been pretty recent, I think, in his paintings. But yeah, his work was pretty influential to me. And my student years looked a lot like his. And that was probably the biggest struggle of my student life, was being able to realize that and move my work away from it. And hopefully, you know, and I'm sure you're always going to wear your influences, you know, on your sleeve. And I owe a lot to him, but hopefully I don't, my art doesn't look like him anymore. I hope.
Nope.
No, it doesn't.
Thank you.
You're fine.
What about you, Victo? Did you just go to school and then start working, or did you have any kind of relationship like that?
Yeah. I was just about to say, both of us have a really influential mentor in our life, and mine is Chris Buzzelli. He was my professor in RISD. And I pretty much owe my career to him too.
Yeah, I love his work, and he's like in interviews and stuff I've read of his beginning of his career and moving away, that's from a distance, he's really influenced me as well. I think he's one of the best illustrators working today.
Yeah. It's not just like his style, but his thinking, his really smart. If you look at, because he has many quite successful students, if you look at their work, none of them looks like his stuff. So he doesn't really train you to have a certain aesthetic, but he trains you how to think, to do conceptual illustration, and how to compose and how to find your own voice. And I think that makes him a really great educator.
Well, with that in mind, I'd be interested just for you guys to give me a couple of names that are working today or not working today, people from yesteryear that have been influential to you or that you think are doing incredible work. Just kind of give the listeners an idea, people they can go look up and enjoy looking at. Do you have any of those recommendations, Jeff?
Yeah, definitely. Victor Ambrus was he's still alive. He's a British illustrator who my parents brought a book of King Arthur, Tales of the Round Table book that was illustrated by him when I was 5 or 6, and it made me want to be an artist. So Victor Ambrus, without a doubt. And John Harris is one of my, I got to meet him last year, and he's a wonderful gentleman and a just sensational artist. And I would buy book covers just for his art. And then, there's so many people that I guess you could say, so I'll just say my friends, the people that I shared the studio with that were really influential to me in the last couple of years of pushing me to become a better artist. Josh George, he's a gallery artist, and he does these amazing paintings. Edward Kinsella III and Leslie Herman and Andrew Wright are three guys who really, they were like, you know, the Andrew and Ted were, you know, a little further in their career than Leslie and I. Leslie apprenticed with Sterling Hunley at the same time that I did. But we all shared a studio for a year. And after that, all of our sort of art and our careers have sort of taken off. And it's really great to have people like that, it's a very lonely profession, where you're kind of sitting alone and it's nice to have people you can call or text or send sketches to. And I don't say that just because they're my friends. I think their artwork is amazing and they're doing some really great stuff. And Irene should hire, those guys.
Good God. How many boards did Sterling Hunley need cut?
Actually, for his first gallery show, we had 100 paintings. So there was a lot.
Wow. Two apprentices making it rain, Sterling.
Oh. Yeah.
What about you, Victo? Any names you can share?
Sure. I really like Basinski. Am I saying it right? Do you know him?
I don't.
I do. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Okay, Basinski. I don't know how to say his first name, but he makes kind of like horror pictures. They kind of give you a chill, but they all have really amazing atmosphere in it. I also really like William Turner for the same reason. Really great atmosphere, but more for his later work, more of the like abstract, just light and shape and shadow than his earlier work. Also really like Klimt, of course, you can see that influence. The details and the decorative elements. Also, I'm quite influenced by the Japanese print masters. There are a few of them, like Jack Chu and Hokusai. If we're talking about people working nowadays, of course, Jeff's work is awesome. It is. It's really fresh and different.
Thank you.
I also really like Chris Salas-Neil or Josh Cochran. I think I tend to like stuff that's kind of different from mine. I really envy people who can pull off simple stuff. Like sometimes almost naive drawing like Brian Ray.
Oh, yeah.
His stuff is really cool too. Yeah.
It's amazing to me. I've been looking at all these different artists and... you talked about how much detail you use Victo, and you communicate a lot with all of that detail. And then you look at like Jeff's work or like Theo Prinz, who I mentioned earlier. I mean, they almost don't. There's almost no the shape. It's like color that creates shape. It's amazing to me that it's just like these splashes of color that they've used to create these shapes. That it's almost effort. It looks effortless. Like they. Yeah. Like they've done almost no work to create the shape, but it's there. It's an amazing economy. It seems like, I don't know. I'm sure it's sort of like poetry, like the, you know, like the haiku.
It's actually harder. It's probably harder.
Probably. Yeah. I don't know. Hell if I know.
Not telling.
You're not telling. Yeah. What's the fastest piece you've ever put together that you've sold, Jeff?
Oh my gosh. The New York Times op-ed, you know, like that was maybe like an hour and a half of actual making of art. But that's a special case. They kind of know that you don't have that much time. I don't know. It's almost like you don't want to say because you don't want people to say, well, I'm going to pay them less because.
Right. Because okay. Fair enough. We won't make anybody answer that question.
It took me 35 years and 8 months and then that 1 hour, that one day to make that. I think, you know, like I try to put in at least a good day on something, but there have certainly been a few things that have probably been less than a day.
But I imagine for both of you, a lot of that work is put in like sort of before you ever touch the page, right? I mean, it's conceptualizing and getting the idea in your head of what you want to go on the paper and the reading that you might do beforehand, right? I mean, that's got to be a big part of the process.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, definitely. If you have a good sketch, like then you're fine. And that's actually the hardest part of teaching or talking to other like aspiring illustrators is they all want to go to the fun stuff, yeah, which is the final. And it's, you know, if you and then they just crash and burn. Whereas if you have a great sketch or thumbnail, then the final is so much fun and it doesn't take hardly any time. Whereas if you haven't really. The trouble is when they think like, oh, I'll just fix that later, and then you get to later and it's a disaster. So the early stage is definitely the most important part, I think.
So true.
All right, well, I've kept you guys about an hour, so I will let you East Coasters go for the night, but thank you both so much for being on the show tonight.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. I'd love to come back and talk more.
All right.